on Chasing the Natty, we have a few spring transfers finding their new homes that we need to touch on. Then we'll be taking a look at some position groups across the country that are, shall we say, less than settled, and we'll be discussing how we're going about handling them in drafts. We have all that and more coming right after this.
Picks his way to the lane and is tripped up, reaching for the end zone. Touchdown. What a start.
Give it to Reed, and there he goes. Nobody's going to catch him. Touchdown.
It's caught. Jeremiah Smith. Touchdown, Ohio State. The legend grows.
This is Chasing the Natty, a college fantasy football podcast. All right, welcome in, everyone. This is Jared Palmgren, host of the Chasing the Natty podcast. I hope you guys are having a wonderful ride to your work on this Monday morning. We are the College Fantasy Football Podcast on the Campus of Canton Podcast Network. You can find us on all of your podcast feeds and on YouTube every Monday morning during this off-season at 6 a.m. sharp. If you want to support the great work we do here, head on over to campusofcanton.com. Subscribe there with any of our phenomenal tiers. Make sure you use that promo code NATTY, N-A-T-T-Y, to get 10% off your yearly memberships. It helps the show out a ton. We've got all sorts of content over there, ranging from CFF, Devi, Campus Canton Leagues, College IDP, College DFS, Underdog Best Ball. Really, if you play it, then we've got content, whether it's tools, rankings, pretty much everything you need to succeed. If you can't go over there and subscribe, that's fine. You can always just show us some love by leaving a like, a comment, and a subscribe on the YouTube side of things. If you're on the podcast side of things, make sure you leave a 5-star review. Make sure you are following the show. Not only does that show us support, but the entire game of college fantasy football in general, a ton of support. If you got any further questions or just want to get in touch for whatever reason, you can find me in the show on Twitter. I'm at @CFF_Jared. The show is at Chasing the Natty, and the guest joining us today is the ever handsome Mr. Joe Arpaese, a.k.a. Purple Rain. You can find his great work at letpurplerain.com. You can find him on X/Twitter at UW_purple_rain, rain spelled R-E-I-G-N. See, Joe, I remember to clarify that this time around. It only took me 3 times you having you on the show. Joe, welcome to the show, man. How you doing?
I appreciate being on again. It's always fun being here and you know, chopping up some college fantasy football, and we're starting to get to that point. We're in May. We're getting closer and closer to 4th of July weekend when our industry really heats up. But that's when it starts getting really fun for us. We're getting out of the spring. We're getting to start talking drafting more and more, and we're going to start doing a little bit of talking about that today. So I'm excited.
Oh, yeah. We got a ton headed our way. We here at Campus Canton have just got started on our CFF guide for this year. I put out the official cover for that as a little teaser for everybody on Twitter, so another reason for you to go find my account there. Make sure you're following there. We got that going. God, Chris K and Ethan Sowers, they're getting ready for all the underdogs. That's gonna underdog best ball stuff that's gonna be dropping any minute here. Joe, you yourself have been just grinding out content after content each week, man. You've been doing a fantastic job over there with your stuff. For those that, again, maybe haven't heard from you in a while and everything, I guess, what can, like, give me like a 3-sentence recap of the kind of stuff that you've been working on over there.
Yeah. Winter and spring was catching up on changes at different teams and what's been going on, spring practices and doing stock reports on it. Now that we've come out of that, I'm going into full blast on draft central content, which is what I call it, focusing on individual players, things that you need to know, draft strategy, et cetera. So really starting to dive headfirst this week. I think the end of this week is going to be the first article of the big push for draft content.
What can they what's the first article going to be about?
First article is called Cornering the Market. It's a handcuffing article going over the different situations from offenses that you want to target, which was a big series that you were a guest on my podcast. Looking at these different offenses that you want to target and, you know, situations that we don't quite have a clear picture yet, and that you may want to go ahead and use a handcuffing, even if it's we kind of think this guy's a starter, but we don't know for certain. So starting to kind of lay out these different scenarios of, here's guys you want to handcuff. Here's, and then later on going into guys who we do believe are the starters and kind of working our way through all sorts of stuff, scheduling content, the big My Guys articles, which will be sometime in June, where I'm kind of really putting my stamp on guys and leading all the way up to my big new and improved draft guide, which will come out at the end of June. I don't know how many pages yet. It is going to be massive, bigger than anything I've done going all the way back to 2008 in my time working in the CFF industry.
Well, definitely looking forward to that. Definitely looking forward to the article you're releasing. Very timely article, considering that that's kind of what we're talking about here today. We're taking a look at 10 different rooms at all different positions here. That really the kind of the idea that kind of sparked this is me always talking to my buddy Mitch Hart. And, you know, he's a big proponent of like zagging when others are zigging, right? He likes taking guys later in rooms that he feels like are less settled than the CFF consensus would have you believe. And, you know, got me thinking. It kind of made me think about like, okay, yeah, let's look at some of these rooms that are kind of less settled than I think we think they are. And let's talk about what kind of strategies we can use when it comes to these rooms, right? Is it better to take the later guy? Is this, in our opinion, settled enough that it is okay to take the guy that is being drafted much earlier? Or, Joe, as I'm sure you'll talk about in your article, like, when is it just best to grab both of them and being okay with having two guys from the same room take up two roster spots on your already limited roster for the most part? Because I know there are some people that really hate handcuffing because of that reason, right? They're like, well, when you handcuff like that, especially in a room where you know one guy's going to be a beast, one guy's not going to be, well, then, yeah, I have a guy that's a beast, but I also have a guy that's just not going to do anything the rest of the year, right? So we'll discuss that.
There's another huge difference between handcuffing. Are you in best ball or are you in a redraft?
Mm-hmm.
You're in best ball, you have more roster spots. You can afford to do it, and you're investing in an offensive system where, okay, hey, you know what? I got two guys and they ended up splitting the backfield, but one could get hurt later in the year and that situation could go nuclear and it's still good for a best ball. If you're in a redraft, you don't have as many roster spots. So you're really putting, like, to use a poker term, you're pushing a lot more chips into the center of the table, investing in a handcuff. So I definitely think there's a big difference in how someone will feel for, you know, trying to corner the market, as I call it, you know, with a situation that's worth investing in, you know, based on, and I've got some where, like, I'm just going to say Colorado State wide receivers. It's not just two guys. Wide open. We quite don't know. So it's kind of a way of just also my articles, what I'm doing too, is I have a note on there. I'm going to be updating these as the summer goes on. So it's also helping set a bookmark. So when it comes, maybe it's July or August, names are going to move around these different articles as well.
No, for sure. And we'll get right into that here in just a second, but as always, during the springtime, it always feels like there's a couple transfers trickling into their new homes and everything. So let's go ahead and discuss some of these guys that are finding their landing spots here, Joe. And we'll start with some running backs here. A couple of interesting guys. I'd say probably the first two are the most interesting in terms of potential CFF impact. We'll start with Branson Robinson here, the former Georgia running back, former four-star, almost five-star, if I remember correctly. Back during his final high school year, and dude just has had terrible injury luck since getting to Georgia, right? And that's kind of the main deal here, right? Yes, we have a former four-star running back moving down to competition, which is always great. This guy was expected to be a beast at Georgia, and he looked really good in the championship game against TCU. A lot of people had high expectations of him. Then he tears his pectoral, and it was suddenly, he may never play football again. Then suddenly, well, we might get him back. And then he really didn't end up doing much last year. I think he averaged less than 3 yards per carry when he was out on the field. So very much didn't look like the former running back that we had expected him to be. But is it possible that him moving down to Georgia State here is the breath of fresh air he needs? He reunites with Del McGee, the guy who recruited him out of high school. So a very clear relationship there. But also, this is a staff that has been, based on Del McGee's history, based on not Freddie Kitchens, Hugh Jackson. Based on Hugh Jackson's history, he tends to go committee with his running backs, right? Like, part of me wants to be invested in this former four-star moving down in competition here, right? But I look at this running back room. Tohwan Payton is the true freshman back there. He's really good. Rashad Amos comes in here. They bring in Jordan Simmons as well. It's a very crowded room very quickly. Joe, are you interested at all in Branson Robinson here at Georgia State?
You know, when Amos was first signed, I felt pretty excited that the talent shook out in a way that we might be able to rely on a back getting a heavier workload. As soon as Robinson was brought in, I felt like that kind of blew that idea out of the water. And with McGee and Jackson, I don't know enough about their histories to feel like I can confidently assume how these carries are going to get divvied out. And when I have a lot of question marks about how that workload's going to get divided, sometimes I'd rather just stay away, especially like when you said, when it seems like the likely course of action is multiple guys splitting that backfield, which we saw quite a bit last year. So for me, it's kind of tough to want to invest in this one.
Yeah, I mean they had a clear RB1 last year in Freddie Brock, but it wasn't like a workhorse back, right? Like there's a difference between having a clear RB1 versus a workhorse guy, right? Because Brock has significantly more carries than the guy behind him, but it just wasn't enough to where you were wanting to start him weekly in CFF. I think I went and looked, and I think he was averaging like 12, 13 touches per game, which is just not what you want.
No.
To me, I think this puts, I agree with you, this puts the nail in the coffin for Rashad Amos. I wouldn't doubt that they brought in Branson and Simmons both because, you know, they bring in Amos and then immediately Amos starts getting flaky on him like he's been at the last couple of stops, right? So I'm just avoiding altogether. Maybe every once in a while, just my heart will take over and I'll draft Branson at the end of like the 30th round of a draft, but like otherwise, I'm not investing too much here. What about Gavin Sawchuk, running back former five-star running back out of Oklahoma, headed to Florida State? Just a weird, weird situation last year, right? A phenomenal end to 2023. I and many others were expecting him to carry that momentum into the next year. And he turned into, I would say, probably the biggest bust in CFF last year, especially at the running back position. Only, you know, 39 carries, 128 yards, averaging just over 3 yards per carry, one touchdown on the year, got outperformed by God knows how many other backs at Oklahoma, and now he transfers out and he lands here at Florida State. It's a very crowded backfield here. Roydell Williams, Cam Davis, Samuel Singleton, Jalen Lucas, the talented freshman, Osmane Kiroma. So my immediate thought is like, oh, well, that's a crowded backfield. Sawchuk wasn't really breaking out of Oklahoma. I'm not going to expect much here, but this is a backfield I keeping an eye on this offseason because boy, oh boy, is Gus Malzahn a kingmaker at running back. Dude is one of the most consistent coordinators, offensive systems for running backs. Not only just good running backs, but like potential league winners. He brings in Sawchuk. This is one of the guys that Malzahn now has brought in himself in addition to Kiroma. Is there a potential that Sawchuk is being brought in here to be the guy, Joe? What do you think?
Now, this is another running back room that I think is just kind of tough to get a handle on right now. Going into the spring, I was leaning toward Williams and Davis being the two guys that probably have the best chance of fighting out to see if one of them could be, a workhorse running back one. And you mentioned Gus Malzahn has a great history with making a workhorse running back. Over the last 3 years, his RB1s have had 232 carries, 226, and 205 carries. That's exactly what we want to see. But before that, he has a history of like his RB1 is in the 150 carry range, and his RB2 is in that 80 to 100 carry range. That's one thing that worries me here with this group. The one name that seemed to jump out to me the most for making a good impact in spring camp was Jalen Lucas. I don't know if I would like count on him being a workhorse running back one, but the fact that like none of the other big names that we were expecting like really jumped out to be like, hey, I deserve 200 carries. That's a little bit of a red flag for me from spring reports. And, so that could also be like, hey, let's bring in another guy. We're just not sure if we have a workhorse here. So you could say that's a good thing about Sawchuk, but, I have a tough time when just he couldn't be the guy last year at Oklahoma. And I don't think that has so much to do with their offensive line and the defenses they face. I think just within that backfield, he couldn't be the guy. That also kind of stands out to me like a red flag where, I still am going to say, like, I'm going to recommend to people, this is a backfield that you should handcuff if you want to take a stab.
No, I agree with you on in terms of like the one year at UCF that's a little worrying, right? Is his first year there at UCF, right? Where, you know, Richardson, Bowser. Now, granted, Bowser got hurt, but even still, you know, we didn't really have a clear RB1 there. And that's probably what's going to happen here potentially at Florida State again, right? It's going to take him a year or two to kind of figure out who's his guy moving forward. We're likely, if there is going to be a guy for Florida State, this is not a question that's going to be answered until game two or three of the season, right? These, like, he's going to see who can actually perform well on the field, especially if nobody's standing out in practice. Let's move on to our third guy here out of the transfer portal, Amarian Peterson, running back at USC. Again, another former four-star prospect heading down to the G5, much like Branson Robinson. Obviously, Quentin Joyner was kind of the prized possession for USC of that class. He's gone too, but Peterson was pretty good in his own right. I'm less interested in whether or not Peterson can produce this year for UTSA, right? I'm more interested in how does this impact Robert Henry. Robert Henry's a guy that I have ranked pretty high. Let's see, where do I have Robert Henry ranked at? Where's my running backs? There they are. I have him RB 15. So I got him ranked pretty up there. And so, but now I got a former four-star coming back in here, and that tells me, that's a little concerning. Especially since, you know, I love what I saw from Henry at the finish last season. You know, four of his last five games saw him get 17 plus touches and a very effective offense, and I expect that offense to be effective again this year. But then I kind of realized that this running back room lost a lot, man. Brandon High, Kavorian Barnes, Rocco Griffin, all three of those guys transferring out, right? They had to bring somebody else in, and so I do think that Peterson's now going to be a very good RB2 for UTSA, so I'm not entirely worried about this impacting Robert Henry. What about you, Joe? How do you feel about it?
You know, UTSA, they've been kind of splitting with their running back one and twos, like both in the 100 carry mark. So I'm like you. I kind of am thinking, you know, Henry should command more than 150 carries. Let's just hope that the coaches now don't want to lean on. Let's just keep splitting the backfield. You know, like, are they just going to fall on the history that we've seen? Are they going to just be like, hey, Henry's the most talented? Was it a lack of talent? One guy separating talent-wise, why they were splitting? I think there's a lot of question marks there. I'm with you. I do think Henry's definitely still a good guy to go with here. I still want to run my numbers since this one, you know, because I just don't quite know where to fit in that running back two yet.
That the volume he was getting to end the year was pretty insane. Like I projected it out to 12 games, and that put him at a 210 carries on the year and 40 targets, which is like insane for CFF purposes, right? That's why he's in my top 15 running backs. So, and I frankly, he could be higher in my rankings, but again, I'm like with you, Joe, where I don't know if I can fully trust that staff to get him that load. So I kind of, even though his projections tell me I should have him higher, I bumped him down a little bit. Let's talk about a couple of these wide receivers. Go ahead.
You mentioned the trust factor and like looking at putting him in rankings and stuff. That's kind of the way I would be viewing it. You know, as I start polishing out rankings is who are the other running backs I have around him in the same tier and where are my trust levels with them? And if I have to knock him down to get him with other guys I trust the same level, that might be kind of, I can guess that might be how I'll probably settle him in.
I mean, I'm going very analytical with my rankings this year because, again, like I'm ranking so many guys and it, like having the project, like having back of the napkin projections helps me out a lot. And one thing I started to do is as I was doing the projections, I'm like, well, I can't just go based solely on projections because, like, you know, then I'd have a guy like Davian Gauss would be like my RB2 on the year. And I'm like, I can't do that. That doesn't feel right. And so I've started doing this thing now where I'm like, I'm giving them like different levels of trust and that kind of creates like a certain percentage I knock off the projection, right? So like for Davian Gauss, he's like a level two concern for me, right? So I knock off about 25% of his projection just to kind of bake in all that uncertainty, right? Robert Henry feels like a guy that I'll probably put at like a level one concern where I'll probably knock off about like 10% of his projected value, and then I feel like that'll account for anything I'm kind of worried about here.
Yeah, and I know I'm going to be taking a similar approach in my rankings where I'm not going to be taking a number off of the projection. I'm still going to use the projection as like the ceiling point, but then like I'm going to focus on the tiers. So let's say it's a guy that we think is expected to be the starter, but he hasn't been named. I might drop him down one tier because we don't know fully that he's the starter yet. So it's like everything from position battle to like what you said, trust. I'll kind of use that to bump guys down
Yeah, and
tiers. And then guys that we know are locked in starters are the guys that I'll rank at their projections.
yeah, I mean that's pretty much what I'm doing here, right? So like this actually first came about because I was looking at the likes of like Malik Sh like actually we'll get to these guys here in a second, but like Malik Sherrod and like Sire Gaines, right? I'm like, okay, I think Sire Gaines is the RB1, or not Sire Gaines, Malik Sherrod is the RB1, right? But I'm not fully certain about that, and I'm not even fully certain that we get like a workhorse back here, right? So I'm like, okay, that's like a level 2 concern for me, right? Because there's like two levels of uncertainty there, so 25% off Gaines, it's like I don't like. He may not be the RB1. This may be more of a committee approach, and he's injured, so he gets like the full knockdown of like 50% off of his like ceiling projection and stuff like that, right? So, but again, we'll get to those guys in a second here. Jonte Cook, wide receiver, formerly of Texas, formerly of Washington, stayed there for about 5 minutes, it seemed like, before he got himself in trouble, and the coaching staff didn't want any part of that. He now lands at Syracuse. Like I said, this is a guy that can't seem to get himself straight right now, but this landing spot, in my opinion, is kind of great on two fronts. One, Fran Brown is a player's coach, and he does seem to be able to kind of keep his guys straight for the most part. So hopefully this is a good thing for Jonte Cook. Two, Syracuse lost a ton when it came to receiving production, right? Like Jackson Meeks gone to the draft, that's 115 targets. Trebor Peña left during the spring portal window, that's 108 targets going to Penn State right there. Aronde Gadsden goes off to the draft, he's drafted. LaQuint Allen was their fourth highest targeted player, he went off to the draft, right? Like they got nothing coming back. Like Darryl Gill Jr. is probably your, or not probably, he is your highest returning receiver here. And so I know, Joe, you were kind of interested in him, and I started to be a little interested in him until this news kind of broke here, right? And Cook is a former four-star wide receiver, a guy that was kind of pushing that five-star level, as we've seen. Hasn't been able to keep himself straight for the most part, but if he can, who are you more interested in here at Syracuse? Darryl Gill, who's been with the program for a year, or Cook, who's got the talent?
You're asking for what's coming out on my Thursday article. But yeah, to give some of those insights, one funny thing was I did my latest Diary of a Draft Man episode after Pena had transferred. I took a shot on Gill late because I was like, oh baby, just like you said, like it seemed like great news for Gill. And then the Cook news came in. Gill played on the outside. And Cook, I actually have him listed as having played a balanced role at Texas, of like where he took his snaps.
It was about 80-20, I think, if I remember correctly,
And
but
so like to me, I still kind of view him as he could be of the two, he seems better suited to move to the slot. It's just kind of what my initial analysis is.
I would agree.
He's also going to be your biggest playmaker. It's just can he keep his head on straight? I'm going to steal a Mike Bainbridge term here. He acts like a knucklehead. So, little props there to Mike Bainbridge. But like that is one thing, like can the co coaches keep him in line? But having a player's coach, those guys, maybe they just need a longer leash so they can keep committed in with the team, So it's like I think Cook just needs to find the right culture from a coaching staff that will work with his knuckleheadedness. But yeah, Cook just seems like the likely guy to me that would probably roll into the slot of the two.
I will probably end up ranking both of them depending on like how I kind of feel about it and everything, and I'll distribute their targets, obviously. Sort of not respectively. Appropriately, from there, and I'll see how that kind of shakes out. But obviously, this is a place where again, we just saw them with Kyle McCord throw an absurd number of times last year, right? The receivers will eat in this offense if they replicate that. And given the two quarterbacks they brought in and out of the portal between Steve Angeli and Ricky Collins, it seems kind of like where they're trying to head again this year. And
So I
so.
just pulled up the snap counts by a position role for last year for Cook. He took 39 in the slot, 75 out wide.
That adds up to more than 100%.
39 and 75 to 114 total.
That's raw snap counts.
Raw, okay. No, the snaps by position role.
Okay, so sorry, yeah. I thought those were percentages. I was like, that's over 100%.
No, but that's what I'm saying. Yeah, so like he's far more in that balanced role.
Agree. Oh yeah, compared to Gill, absolutely.
From where he played, even though he did play more on the outside.
No, I agree. I agree 100%. Last guy we have here for the transfer portal section here, Yabir Knight, wide receiver out of James Madison, headed over to SMU here, going from JMU to SMU here. Joe, we discussed on your pod back when I came on your show, we were discussing, you know, wide receiver one systems, and we did discuss the Rhett Lashley system, and we have not gotten that quintessential wide receiver one out of Rhett Lashley's system the last couple of years. I am doubtful we're going to get it again this year, but could Yamir Knight be the key?
You know, Jared, it's tough to say, man. There's not a lot of returning experience, good returning production with the SMU wide receivers. Looking at the history of what you have from Rhett Lashley, his wide receiver ones can be both balanced and outside guys, but his wide receiver two, the majority of the time is an outside. Wide receiver three of his, the majority of the time is an outside, which makes me kind of think the odds are, even his wide receiver one, two, and three. So if I'm just kind of playing the odds, the betting game, I would bet on someone who could play somewhere in the slot, even if it's that balanced role. And you know, Knight played in the slot. That does help him. But one of the other things that I'm kind of curious about, Chris Johnson transferred over, the running back from Miami. But in the spring, they were moving him and having him play out at wide receiver, motioning him back for handoffs. Don't really know, like, is it going to be more of a small gimmicky role? And Knight was brought in to be the main receiver. I think it's tough to say. I think the safest thing we can say when it comes to SMU wide receivers, and I've been this way the last couple of years, I want there to be a guy. We really don't know. Let's wait for spring camp reports and find out more then. Fall camp reports and find out more then.
I would agree, right? It seems like there's been a conscious effort the last couple of years with Lashley, even though he was known for a top-end wide receiver. He's been trying to spread the ball out a ton more, and it probably won't change this year with Kevin Jennings being back at quarterback, right? You're not going to have a guy that's going to be able to sling it wherever his top guy is. You're going to need to create those route trees for him to be able to read very easily, be able to distribute it where to wide-open guys, so you can't always rely on the same guy over and over again. So I agree. Before we move on to the Would You Rather discussions, I do need to make one little PSA, and that is that I goofed big time last week when I discussed wide receiver Mark Hamper, the former Wisconsin-Idaho wide receiver. I thought it was official that he had transferred to New Mexico, and I got way too excited, way too over my skis. And no, he broke my heart this week and decided to go to Cal because Cal doesn't like, nobody likes Cal. And so now Cal is like at being desperate in terms of what people they're grabbing at running back and wide receiver out of the portal because Brian Harsin's scaring every offensive weapon they have away. And unfortunately, Mark Hamper was one of those guys. Didn't do the smart choice and just go to New Mexico and, you know, put up 2,000 yards. He's going to go to Cal where he's probably going to be, you know, a 300-400-yard wide receiver because, you know, smart choices. Anyway,
maybe Cal just has way more money left over because everyone left.
I guess so. All right, Joe. So let's get into the meat and potatoes of today's show. Again, what we're going to do, we're going to do some kind of would you rather questions, which are going to be like, we're going to look at some of these rooms where, you know, two or three guys maybe are coming off in drafts. A lot of times there's a big discrepancy in their draft value. And we're going to discuss here today, like what in our opinion is the right move to do, right? Whether that's grabbing both guys, whether it's worth it to draft the first guy that's coming off the board and like, yes, we're pretty certain that this is the guy, it's worth taking him this high. Or is it better to wait and just grab the second guy, and how much of a percentage chance are you likely to still get that guy on the back end? So let's dive right on into it. And we'll start with a running back scenario. And I kind of alluded to this earlier in the show, and so we'll just get it out of the way here. And that is the Boise State running back room, right? Our two main guys here being taken in drafts are Zaire Gaines. Last year, he was a true freshman back. And then we have Malik Shra, the transfer running back coming out of Fresno State. The case for Zaire Gaines, right? This is the one that's going higher. He's being drafted as RB20 in drafts, right around the, you know, mid to late fourth round. As I mentioned, tons of hype for him coming in as a true freshman last year. Even with Ashton Ginty on the roster, people were gushing about the potential that Gaines had. And boy, did we see it almost immediately. We didn't get to see a lot before Gaines got hurt, but 7.6 yards per carry, 4.3 yards after contact per attempt, 64.5% breakaway percentage. This dude was a monster, even in the shadow of Ashton Ginty. If healthy and fully recovered, he is the best back on this roster, no doubt in my mind. Problem is, he's, like I said, he got injured last year, and not only did he get injured, he was out the rest of the year, and he barely, if at all, participated in spring practice. That's a huge red flag for me, especially for a guy going as high as the fourth round. Meanwhile, Malik Sherrod, yes, he has his own injury concerns, right? He missed a good chunk of last season after he went down. I think part of that was him kind of shutting it down, saying, hey, I'm going to preserve my red shirt transfer after the year, all that jazz. So maybe he wasn't as hurt as, you know, him only playing four games would suggest. But Sherrod's going here in the, like, you know, mid to late 14th round, RB58 off the board. Yes, like I said, yeah, he had a rough year last year, 3.3 yards per carry before he went down, easily his worst year. But him getting some time to kind of sit down and get himself healthy for here, it seems like he's already been a standout in spring, right? There's been a lot of positive buzz. We saw in the spring game, he got three carries, ripped off a long touchdown. Ooh. The coaches said, yep, you're good, you're done. We're not going to risk you any further. Meanwhile, guys like Dylan Riley and Jonbry Dubar got the carries the rest of the day. To me, it seems like Sherrod is absolutely playing himself into a big role for Boise State this year. So I'd much rather take the shot on Malik Sherrod there in the 14th round. I've started being a bit more aggressive about it, rather than take the shot on, again, unfortunately, a very talented but very injured Gaines there in the fourth round. What do you think, Joe?
I'll say this. Sometimes I like to do what I call nameless projections. So it's just Boise State RB1, Boise State RB2. And you're not taking anything into, you know, personal things into effect.
Mm-hmm.
I did that, and I did that with this team, and I did it with the feeling that the coaches mentioned they're going to run more two-back sets this year, which means they're going to try and get between these two and Dubar. I think they're going to make sure that they're getting these guys on the field a lot.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have certain type of plays and things designed for each one that each running back does best.
Yep.
I ran my nameless projection. I have a 20-point, and this is just a first pass too, not even massaging anything. 20-point total fantasy difference between RB1 and 2 this year. And part of why I look at this too is I see the way that this running back room will go. Let's assume Gaines is not fully healthy game one.
Yep.
Just let's use that as a scenario. Sherrod is the main guy getting the main amount of carries. Dubar's in there to kind of help out. He takes a little bit of the load off. And they rotate in Gaines for however many carries he can handle with Dubar.
Yep.
As he gets healthier as the year goes on and Gaines playing more, I think you're going to start seeing Gaines and Sherrod splitting the carries 50-50. And then by the end of the year, you could see something where Gaines is getting 2/3 of the carries or 3/4 of the carries, while it's Gaines and Sherrod, you know, both on the field a lot. So what's difficult is I think my gut tells me both Gaines and Sherrod are going to be the RB1. It's just going to be at different times during the year.
Mm-hmm.
So, and considering that, like I said, my nameless first round projection, I'm viewing that both of them really equally because of how the workload distribution, I could just imagine seeing it playing out that way. I'm going to take the cheapest guy here. Fourth round for someone that, you know, I don't think is going to be statistically that much better. Let's say Gaines ends up RB1, which I think in my gut, I would buy in that, but I don't think the price, a fourth round price for how many other running backs or a good receiver are out there. I'm just going to let other people pay the price on Gaines, and mm-hmm. I'll take Sherrod. I mean, I would take Sherrod right now as a sixth rounder, no problem. let alone 14th. So I think he has a lot of value where he's at. And he's going to be the safest, most reliable guy in that backfield all year long.
The Gaines is tough, right? Because, like, if he is RB1, he could be a league winner, just like Ginty was, right? If I gave Sire Gaines RB1 numbers for Boise State, and it's my RB1 numbers, so this is about, like, 210 carries. What did I give Sherrod? Let's see. 210 carries and 35 targets, right? Gaines, based on the efficiency we saw last year, again, now, is that the most sustainable efficiency in the world? Absolutely not, right? But that's like 340 fantasy points. That's a league winner, right? In order to get Sire Gaines down, I gave him RB2 numbers, which I agree with you, Joe. I think that there's room for two backs to be really good for CFF here at Boise. They just run the ball so much. You're looking at 170 carries for Gaines and 20 targets. That still is 200 plus fantasy points. The problem is, does he get healthy? What does his staff do with Gaines? We don't know, right? They could very well be. They just shut him down for the year. They're like, hey, we got Sherrod. We got Dubar. We got Riley. There's no reason for us to rush you back out there and to risk re-injuring you when you could just sit another year. We can use, well, they used his red shirt last year, but you could potentially get another medical waiver this year. And then we just bring you on for your third year. You go off for, 1,500 yards and go to the NFL just like Gianti did.
And right? And you don't risk him being on tape and people trying to poach him.
Exactly. Right. So, like, I think there's a decent chance that there's, again, I'm not going to say it's like a 50-50 shot, but, like, I say it's like a 15% chance that Gaines just hardly sees the field this year.
Maybe. And what I really like about Sherrod here, the Boise State offense is one of the best PPR offenses in fantasy. Mm-hmm. And Sherrod is great catching the ball out of the backfield. So I have Sherrod listed as the RB1, but that RB1 projection I ran was 217 rushing attempts. Like you said, they run it a lot, but they throw it a bunch. Mm-hmm. And I had 50 targets in there as well for Sherrod. So that's one thing I like, where even if, let's say, Sherrod isn't leading in carries, I think he's going to get a huge chunk of the targets.
Yeah, see, I got Sherrod currently at 210 carries and 35 targets. My projections, I put in what I call a reasonable ceiling, right? So it's not like the absolute tippy top of what I think they'll get to, right? But, like, it is like what I think is a decent, good case scenario, not best case scenario, but a great case scenario. Let's move on.
I'll throw this out there because I do something a little similar but different. I use something that I call fantasy ceiling. So for whatever position we're talking, let's say Boise State running back one, what was the highest fantasy points ever scored? Then I compare the projection to that and have it come out as a percentage. Mm-hmm. So obviously the RB1 from Boise is going to be blown. That ceiling's blown out of the water from last year.
Oh yeah.
But my projection's at 64% of the fantasy ceiling of the Boise State RB1. And that RB2, who I think should outperform what we've seen historically from Boise, my projection's at 109% of that fantasy ceiling, which, in my opinion, is very, very reasonable.
All righty. Let's move on to your next guy here, Joe. You're going to touch on the only quarterback room that we'll be discussing today, which
feels hard finding quarterbacks.
we both kind of discussed, like, with this year, with so many quarterbacks coming back, right, and it just being such a deep year, like, there's not as many quarterback battles to really be on the lookout for, but boy, is this one of the big ones, right? Because, like, in my opinion, this is the John Mateer, Zevi Eckhaus quarterback battle of this year. Whoever wins this job very much has top 10 potential for CFF purposes. Of course, we're talking about the North Texas quarterback situation. Joe, I'll let you take over from here, man. What's going on here?
You know, what's tough about it is that we were hoping we would get a named starter in the spring. It's what we all wanted. We really didn't get that. The closest I think we got was that in all of the major scrimmages, I can always say his name wrong, Poffenbarger. Mm-hmm. He was always the first guy to take the field while both him and Messemaker were splitting the first team reps. So the one thing that I do kind of look at with this is, like, you can kind of say it looks like the coaches are leaning toward Poffenbarger. Mm-hmm. but they didn't name him. So that's one thing that, like, you could say it leads a little, cause for concern. I personally would like to see Mestemaker be the guy here. Because, I mean, Mestemaker, he's got that running ability that could add something different in this offense. So, like my heart wants Mestemaker. My brain is telling me I think they probably are leaning Poffenbarger. But, once again, it's just you could, this is a situation you could handcuff it. I'm kind of starting to lean like it might be Poffenbarger. And what's tough about this is and this is why we only have one quarterback on here, is like, it's hard to say who would you draft at this ADP, which is basically what our discussion is here today. So by default, I'm going to say I'm taking Poffenbarger just because I'm going to kind of lean on him being the first one in and me kind of leaning on the idea of when it comes to fall camp, for Mestemaker to get this job, I think it's probably Mestemaker is going to have to play way better than he did in the spring throughout all of the fall. And Poffenbarger is going to have to play worse than he did during the spring. I think that's the only way that you probably see Mestemaker leapfrog him.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with you, Joe, for the most part. And like, just for context for everybody else, as Joe kind of mentioned, there's not a ton of ADP difference between these two guys, right? Poffenbarger is coming off the board at QB 44, about like mid to late 18th round. Meanwhile, Mestemaker is QB 60 in like that mid to early 24th round, which, 6 rounds seems like a bit of difference, right? But also when you're in the second half of the draft, there's not really a huge difference in the value of guys between, 18th round versus the 24th round. My thing with this is that it's such a hard read on this quarterback room because you have Poffenbarger, who is like clearly an experienced starter, even if it's at the FCS level, right? He's got the reps, he's a veteran presence, right? But he hasn't had as much time as Mestemaker to read this offense. Meanwhile, Mestemaker is the exact opposite, where like, he's been with the system, he kind of knows it. But you're talking about a guy that lacks any kind of starting experience since freshman year of high school, let alone here in college, right? His only start since his freshman year of high school has been the bowl game, which, like, as you mentioned before, Joe, he did very, very well and passed for almost 400 yards. The problem is, I think, and I think that staff thinks as well, that there's a decent chance that that was just a flash in the pan, right? Like a guy that couldn't even start in high school. And I heard somebody mention, I know on the G5 podcast or G5 Hive podcast, the beat reporter they had on there kind of mentioned, like, oh, well, Mestemaker has some really good quarterbacks ahead of him. He had Deuce Adams, who's at Louisville now, but like, it was not anything that like I would be sitting there like it's not like he had Malachi Nelson or Aiden Childs ahead of him or something like that, right? It like this was a room that if Mestemaker was great, he probably would have been starting in that room over the likes of a Deuce Adams. But that also kind of leads the air of mystery for Mestemaker and the fact that again he could have been just an overlooked guy that has a ton of untapped potential. So
I think the would you rather for this is would you rather only draft Poffelberger right now or handcuff it? I think that might be the real question.
I would agree. I think I have just drafted Poffenbarger, but here's the thing, like if you're so confident that you're only drafting Poffenbarger, why aren't you taking him higher in a draft, right? Like yeah, you can play the ADP game, which I love playing the
Yeah.
ADP game all day long, right? But like
If there's a
you're
guy you
talking
want, pull the trigger.
exactly, or like if it's a guy that you think has top 10 potential in this offense, like you're not taking him as QP 44, right? So I would say, that's kind of my response to that. What about you, Joe? Where do you fall on that?
No, like I said before, I think it's a either you have enough faith that you're just drafting Poffenbarger or take the safe move, handcuff both. These guys are left out of my handcuff article. I'm now kind of on the just Poffenbarger train because, like I summarized before, I think Mestemaker has to outplay what he did in the spring. Poffenbarger has to play worse. I don't think that's worth investing in that scenario.
Alrighty. Let's move on to my second would you rather question here, and that is involving the Penn State backfield here, with one Nicholas Singleton being taken in the late second round here, averaging the 209 pick, and then his partner in crime, Catron Allen, being taken a whole 10 rounds later there in the mid to late 12th round, which when you just look at the stats, it is kind of crazy that there's this much of a gap between them, especially considering the fact that the case for Allen is dude had higher volume last season, right? Between his rushes, between his receiving, if you were just a volume guy, he's the guy you got to go for. Meanwhile, Singleton was more efficient both in receiving and rushing, right? He was better with the limited touches that he got. I say limited in the loosest term. The dude still had over 200 touches, but limited compared to what Allen got. And he was more touchdown efficient than Allen, right? Like Singleton had 17 touchdowns in his 16 games versus Allen only having 10. Another thing is obviously Singleton had a lot more receiving work. You know, he had 41 receptions versus Allen had 18. In a PPR league, that's obviously huge. But if you're just looking at raw production, is that enough to, is the fact that Singleton got more touchdowns last year, which we know isn't always, good year to year, that touchdown rate's not always something you can count on year to year, to Singleton getting way more reception work, even though we do know that Allen can catch out of the backfield. There's not a huge difference between their efficiency in the passing game, right? Is that really worth 10 rounds difference between these two guys? I personally lean towards the Singleton should probably be going a couple rounds later. Allen should probably be going a couple rounds higher, and the gap between these two should shrink a little bit, because currently, as I have it, I have Singleton as my RB22, which according to ADP means that I should be expecting to see him come off the board around the fifth round, because that's where currently Antoine Raymond goes as the RB22. And then where do I have Allen at? Allen I have as, where are you, Katron? Can't find you. There he is, RB49, which comes off the board at the middle of the 11th round, so not much higher for Allen. But definitely this is me saying, like, Singleton's going too high. The gap between these two should be smaller. What do you think, Joe?
I think you mentioned before your risk factors and how you do that with your rankings. Singleton is extremely safe, and this is a year where running backs are going to be flying off the board in the first 2 to 3 rounds. So Singleton's value is being pushed up because of how reliable we know he can be. So it's not necessarily like his ADP is matching a projection as much as I think people are drafting him for his floor versus his ceiling. So I'm a guy, I would take Singleton in the second round. He's right on that border with the ADP, Yeah, second round. I would take him for that reliability as like a running back 2, maybe 1, I think that safe floor is something that just this year, there's only a handful of running backs who have it. So he's being pushed up. And because of the way that the drafting's going, I think his ADP is justified. So I would actually say, I would take him. I would also take Allen. I'd take both. So it's one of those like there's not a bad choice of this group. I think Allen is the best value play of the two. The one thing that you could say is a little worrying, though, with Allen, if you look at Penn State offensive coordinator, you look at his history, his running back 2, there's only once that a guy's had similar volume. That was 2019 at Buffalo with Kevin Marks, where Marks had 227 carries, 16 targets. The majority of the time, they don't get the same workload. Kevin Marks in 2018 came close, 180 carries. Well, so like there is some history that you can say, we should see the same thing from Allen. And they have so many people back in the offense that stability, like you would crave it for your running back roster. So I don't think there's a lot of risk with Allen's workload going down. And even if it does, I think it's going to be really minor. I don't think it's going to be enough that would warrant, if you could only take one of the two, taking Singleton over Allen. I'd rather take the value play of Allen and try and shoot for some other running back in the second round if I had to do a pick one of these two.
Well, this kind of brings up an interesting question, right? Because you just referred to Allen as the RB2, but
the fantasy RB2.
How do you determine that, right? Because like in real life, right? Like if you give a guy 238 touches versus, you know, Singleton getting, mm-hmm. doing math off the top of my head, you know, like 213 touches. Technically, Allen's the RB1 because he's getting more volume. It's just that Singleton was more productive.
Yep.
Right. So it's like, does that translate to this year to where, all right, well, Singleton was doing better with his touches last year, so we're going to get him more touches? Or do they just repeat what they did this year? Because like you mentioned, everything's coming back. It worked well for them. They just couldn't close out the deal versus Notre Dame. Right.
I think with these two, they know what the formula is, how to use them. And I think maybe also one of the things that the coaching staff pushes to them is like, hey, we're going to be able to give you guys production, but not overwork you. That's what you want for your NFL career. So I do think that might be another approach that this coaching staff has in trying to sell to not only the guys on the team, but the future prospects.
Potentially. All right. Moving on to our next one here. You wanted to discuss the Texas running back situation. Currently, mm-hmm. CJ Baxter going off the board as RB27 in the early sixth round. Trey Wisner coming off the board as RB41 at the beginning of the ninth round. Joe, what's got you interested here?
What has me interested is that I'm wheels up on Trey Wisner.
I'm kind of getting there too.
And I'm liking the fact that he's at a good value. My gut just tells me Baxter's not going to be healthy at the start of the year. There's several running backs that I'm looking at this year where I feel like, hey, here's the healthy guy. They play a lot before and we know they can be productive. And their main competition probably will be maybe 80% at best by week one. Like Sherrod's one of those guys you could say that about, you know.
Reuben Owens is another one.
Reuben Owens, I've been planting a flag on him. He's one of probably my biggest one. But with Wisner, I think that's going to be the case. And we know that even if they split production, you know, you can still have a productive RB1 in this offense. I think Wisner and I think the fact like he's good catching the ball.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get as many, you know, receiving touchdowns last year as Jadon Blue, but like he's good running and catching it. He can do everything that Sarkisian needs him to do in the offense, and they can lean on him as the workhorse while Baxter goes in and maybe gets 5 carries a game. But if Wisner really is taking off and is the hot hand, and this is how I am about Reuben Owens too, like if they seize the opportunity early in the year to show they can be the hot hand, the coaches aren't going to want to put the, you know, the hot running horse back in the barn. They're going to keep feeding it, and Baxter will have to like work his way into trying to get 8 or 10 carries a game. So, you know, I think that this is a situation for Wisner. Like he's the value play here. Let everybody else go after Baxter. Like you're drafting injured goods and someone that maybe won't be 100% until the end of September.
At the very earliest, right? Baxter's another one like Sire Gaines where it just feels like a landmine. It feels like it goes so bad so quickly here, especially if we get into the fall and they start talking about like, oh yeah, we're hoping he might be ready by the end of September, mm-hmm. or like you said, right? The fact that he hasn't been hardly mentioned
at all.
He should
be suiting up. Like those sort of comments exactly. They sound confident, but they aren't.
No, and it's like, the fact that he's not mentioned really at all in spring ports just makes me think that he's really not really like similar to kind of Gaines, right? Where it's like there's a decent chance he just may not be part of the plan for Texas this year, right? If they feel confident in the guys like Wisner, Gibson, other guys like that they can be like, all right, Baxter, you sit back, you get healthy, we'll need you for a playoff run later this season, right? Let's let those guys take care of it right now. Mm-hmm. Again, things could go real bad for Baxter there in the sixth round. Yeah, absolutely, Wisner has to be your pick there in the ninth round. This probably brings him up a little bit, but even so, that's, you know, it's a Steve Sarkisian running back one. That's great for fantasy. Now, last year wasn't so great. Yes, Steve Sarkisian still got his 1,000-yard back. It only took them, what, 16 games to get there with Wisner, but that is also the thing that I'm a little bit worried about with Wisner, and I do think he should not be drafted in the same way as like, you know, Bijan Robinson or even a Jonathan Brooks would have been if Brooks came back for another year, right? Because if you look at the advanced metrics, Wisner is definitely a tier below those guys, right? Like Brooks and Bijan were averaging over 6 yards per carry. Wisner was about 4.5 yards after contact per attempt. Wisner was a step below Brooks and Bijan by almost a full yard on that. breakaway percentage. He's about 8 to 10% below Brooks and Bijan in that, and he's about half a yard per route run lower than Brooks and Robinson. So I think that people can't quite expect from Wisner, you know, the ceiling of a Bijan, the ceiling of a Jonathan Brooks, right? But it still is going to be enough to where he's going to be a great, or a good, at least a very good CFF back, especially if, mm-hmm. you know, Arch Manning works out and that whole offense is cooking.
Agreed.
Let's move on to our next one here. I want to talk about the Kansas backfield. This is one I don't think we've really been talking about, but it's weird to me because I feel like everything should point to Daniel Hyshaw being the RB1 here for Kansas, but I just am not getting that vibe based on the way people are talking about what little information I'm able to get out of this backfield, right? On paper, Hyshaw is the better running back here, right? Mm-hmm. 5.2 yards per attempt in his career. The dude has been limited in touches, but when he's out on the field, he has performed well for Kansas. He's been with the team for 4 years. He knows this system. He knows this staff. He should be the guy. They bring in LeSean Williams from Iowa. LeSean Williams, man, has not been great his career. He's averaged about 4.1 yards per attempt, and that was heavily boosted by what he did in 2023, where he was averaging almost 5 yards per carry. Good year for him, but then the very next year, he comes back to Iowa, and he's averaging less than 2 yards per carry. LeSean is not exactly the most impressive running back that you can really ask for, but he's coming in, and what little information I'm able to gather seems to suggest that, like, Williams might have the inside track here as RB1, and, like, I just don't know if I really believe that, if I'm being real, because, like, there was some stuff about Hyshaw, right, at the end of the year being floated around because he was away from the team, but clearly I don't think it had any real bearing because he's back with the team now. There was no real talk about him transferring or anything.
Well, that situation, he left the team for a personal family matter.
Yeah,
which my hunch tells me could have been like not
death in the family.
Well, yeah, something like that, like a green flag, not a red flag, sort of a thing. And he did return back to the program, but he left before the winter portal opened, and that's when Kansas got LeSean. So the fact they brought him in makes sense if you go back in time, and Kansas and the coaches might be going, we don't know if Hyshaw's coming back. We need somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that makes sense why they did that move. Now, Hyshaw came back. He participated in spring camp, which is good. He's back and he's active with the team. The one thing where I could see, like you mentioned, it seems like LeSean is getting, like, has a slight edge. It might just be the coaches are like, hey, LeSean's been here all winter doing all the workouts, man. He's going to start with the ones. You know, Daniel, you'll have to work your way in, but, you know, hey, we know you. You've been in this program for years, but we're putting LeSean in there with the ones just because he's been doing the work this offseason, you know, that you were still away taking care of what you needed to take care of. So my hunch is it could be that. And I felt like that looking at some stuff with Ohio State this year, like with Max Klar starting out spring camp on the number 3 offense.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of these coaches just might be, you know, hey, some guys have paid their dues and they're going to start camp a little higher. That would be my guess, but this is purely throwing stuff on the wall guess, because I don't have any insights, no, you know, nothing like that I can base it on. Just being an old college football coach and just imagining maybe how things would play out. But getting to the question here, who would you rather? I have faith in Hyshaw, like you said, he's the better running back.
Mm-hmm.
I have faith in him where I would take a shot on him. And I believed all last season he can carry the load as a workhorse running back in 2025.
Mm-hmm.
So I have faith in him, and I would take the higher price based on that faith, where if it's LeSean, at best you're getting a running back one that's splitting carries with Hyshaw.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, your ceiling that you're banking on if you're taking him as one of your last running backs. So to me, I'd rather take the risk on the much higher ceiling and the higher talent level.
Yeah, I mean, this is a system that we love in CFF, right? I mean, this is Lance Leopold's system. The offensive coordinator, Jim, what is his name?
Let's see here. Matt Lubbock is the new one that came in from Nevada. Jim Zabrowski.
Zabrowski. I was saying, I'm like, it's one of those names that ends with a ski on the end. he comes
They're
in.
called Polish people.
He's been with Lance Leopold really since the days of Buffalo, followed him to Kansas. He's going to run the exact same system they've been running there, right? So like I fully ex anticipate they're going to have a clear RB1, right? Because that's just what they've always done. I mean, they may even run well enough to where they got two guys, and that could be, like you said, where LeSean Williams is still that guy. I gave LeSean Williams and Daniel Hyshaw the exact same projection, right? And then because, like as I mentioned earlier, I gave him that kind of level two worry because, again, like I'm like, I don't know how this is going to shake out between the two of them. So it took 25% off of their projection on both of them. That ended with Daniel Hyshaw still being in my top 40 running backs and LeSean Williams being down at RB 56. And again, like I said, that's with them having the same volume, same receiving work and everything. There is a difference between the ceiling of Hyshaw versus the ceiling of Williams. I'm going to take that shot with Hyshaw. Especially again, if I got him as my RB4, like
My initial blind projection on these two, I have Hyshaw with twice as many carries. But like I said, I have a lot more just faith in Hyshaw being the guy.
Yeah, this is like if you're a believer in LeSean Williams, congratulations, dude's free. You can grab him last three rounds of your draft. But Hyshaw, I'm okay with him, especially in that, RB4-5 range. Yeah, I'm feeling
Now,
pretty good about that.
I'll throw this out there too for Williams. You could, if you take a stab at him as your last running back in a best ball. I'm not going to recommend this in a redraft, but in a best ball, I don't think he's good enough that he could be truly a nuclear option if Hyshaw got hurt. Just because I think his athletic ceiling limits him from that. But he'll be a super high workload and still fantasy productive guy in that scenario because he will likely be the RB2 in a really good system. So that is a positive. If you do want to take a shot on him with a last running back pick, let's at least end with something positive about Williams in this one.
For sure. All right, moving on to our next guy here. We'll keep this going a little bit quicker here. That way we don't run out the clock here too much. Oh my God, I can't speak anymore. Ah, my gosh. Joe, Iowa State wide receivers. We got Chase Sewell here coming off the board early fourth round, wide receiver 10 in ADP. Xavier Townsend, the other wide receiver that Iowa State brought in here way later, 24th round, wide receiver 87 here. What's the deal between these two? Are you willing to spend that high on Chase Sewell, or are you going to try to take the shot on Townsend closer towards the end of drafts?
So in my last Diary of a Draft Man episode, I was screaming at the end of the draft, how has nobody drafted Townsend yet? I was just like, and I had already gotten a share of him, I believe, which is why I was just staying away from drafting him. Because early in the year, I don't want to double up too much on players. So I was staying away from him and going to take a shot on other upside guys late in the draft. But like, I'm planting my flag. Townsend might be the best single value right now wide receiver that you can find in fantasy drafts. This offense will have, it can cater to two good fantasy receivers. They have a NFL caliber quarterback coming back. And I believe Townsend's a lock to be the slot. I don't think there's anyone that's going to push him to be the starter here. And that balanced or slot position is typically the number two. But I'm looking over like last year and with Noel's kind of a, he's a unique guy, 211 fantasy points. But like you can get 150 fantasy points out of a wide receiver too, who you can get. I mean, I'd be willing to take him even a bit higher up in the 20s of rounds. So for me, I just love the value that you're getting out of him this late in drafts. And Chase Sowell is one of those guys, like, I think it's 50-50 if he hits 200 fantasy points. I think he's a guy we all maybe got really too high on during the winter portal. And I have a feeling a lot of us are starting to come back down on him as the spring has progressed and we're heading into the summer. I think he's a guy that we could see his ADP, probably drop into the fifth round.
Or it's you, so Sol drops in the fifth round. Sorry, I
Fifth,
thought you meant,
correct.
I thought you
Yes.
meant,
No.
okay.
Yeah, Sol's a guy who I think maybe we all were too high on
Gotcha.
back in like February, and he's slowly coming back down to earth because we're not sure if he's a lock for 200 fantasy points.
So I'll start with Townsend because I listened to you and I listened to Ethan Sowers. Both of you, it seems, are, in love with Xavier Townsend in this offense,
Well, and at the value he's at, I
and at
think you
the
got to
values.
combine all those things.
But here's the thing, I have him in my rankings projected as my wide receiver 84. He's right. His ADP is right where I expect him to be, and he is held back immensely by his lack of efficiency. The dude over the last 2 years there at UCF averaged just under 10 yards per catch. Right?
I do want
Meanwhile,
to say it's not the best offense for receivers either.
but
I think a
maybe,
change of offensive
but
system will help too.
here's the thing. Here's the thing, Joe. When my project with my projections, it takes into both into account the efficiency of the receiver themselves and the system they're coming into. Right? So I got him projected out at 85 targets. Roughly, which is about what Jalen Noel averaged in 12 games over the last 2 years, right? Jalen Noel averaged 13.8 fantasy points in that, or not 13.8 fantasy points, 13.8 yards per catch in that offense, right? If I were to just give Townsend what Noel did in efficiency the last couple of years, I got him projected out as 814 yards, 7 touchdowns, right? That gets him roughly about 152 fantasy points. That gets him as high as like wide receiver 45-ish for me. Right. But if I include his lack of production at UCF, right, that brings him down a lot. That brings him down to a projection of about 134.4 half point PPR. And that's what gets him really down there. Meanwhile, Sol is kind of the opposite, right? Where he's coming into that spot in the offense that is hyper efficient, right? Talk
Yes.
about 15.5 or yards per catch, right? Catching about two-thirds of the balls that came that outside wide receiver's way. Meanwhile, Sol himself was highly efficient at Eastern Carolina. Yeah, do I expect him to be averaging 16 yards per catch, moving up from the AAC to the Big 12? No, but I do think it could be roughly around, still where Higgins was hitting at last year. Higgins himself was an FCS to Big 12 transfer, right? So I got Sol projected out. I think he'll end up being, or he is in my top 15 wide receivers. Am I drafting him top 10? No. I haven't been able to get a share of him yet, but I totally understand why people like him more than Townsend. I
Oh
just
yeah.
can't get there on Townsend right now. I need to see it to believe it.
And I think that's a fair point here. And another thing, even I'll say something to counteract my enthusiasm for him. He's someone you're taking in your last couple of wide receivers of a best ball league. So someone like myself, I'm typically shooting for high ceiling guys at that point, which Townsend's not going to be. I think the selling point on Townsend, if you're taking a shot on him late, is for like what I actually think will be a more reliable floor of we know with this offense he should get a certain amount of targets, get a touchdown here and there. Like if you're looking for that safe guy that you can kind of plug in, and that might fit it more if you took too many risks in your top half of your wide receivers. I think that is one thing that is a good selling point on him, but I actually don't draft that way. So I'm bringing up counterpoints on that. But it's one of those things too. I think once I start really getting through my projections and my rankings, Townsend might come down a little bit. But right now, I'm just really excited about him because of potential ceiling and how cheap he is.
See, my, I agree with you on the cheap part. Again, dude's going, last five, six rounds of a draft. I just don't see the ceiling. That's like my big thing is I just don't really see the ceiling. Because even Noel last year,
I'll
right? What?
rephrase. Offensive historical ceiling.
Let me see. What did Noel finish as last year? Because I don't even think he even finished that high. Where are you
I
at?
have him in my spreadsheet at about 211 fantasy points.
Is that regular season only?
The full season. Full
Yeah, see,
season. Yeah.
I only care about the 12 games that count for us. So Jalen,
well, and I
Noel
look at two
was
things.
wide
My
receiver 30.
historical one, I do the whole season, and then when I do projections, I break everything down to a per game.
Gotcha. Okay, so yeah, Noel was wide receiver 30 in total points and in fantasy points per game. Where are we at? Noel was wide receiver 44. So literally exactly where I said, like, if you had just taken what, or if you gave Xavier Townsend the efficiency that Noel got, you get right in that wide receiver 40, 45 range, which again, to me, that's not a ceiling. That's a floor. That's a nice floor. So, all right, moving on to the next one here. Right. Let's go talk about the Ole Miss wide receivers, where Dejon Stribling is currently coming off the board in the early sixth round as wide receiver 16. Meanwhile, Caden Lee is coming off the board as wide receiver 40 in the mid to late 11th round. The selling point on Dejon Stribling is very clear. He's playing in that outside spot that has given us Trey Harris the last couple of years, right? It's a spot that we have seen over and over again in that Lane Kiffin offense. If there's going to be a wide receiver for CFF purposes, that's where you target with Lane Kiffin. Stribling was great at Oklahoma State last year, very efficient. He projects extremely well. Looking at my rankings, I currently have him projected as my current wide receiver 15. He currently projects at about 176 half PPR points for me, right? Again, it's a match made in heaven. It feels really good. That's why he's going very high. Here's the thing, though. Caden Lee is kind of interesting as well, right? He, one, performed very well as a freshman last year, right? He was second on the team in targets, third on the team in production. He stands to inherit a potential wide receiver, definitely wide receiver two, if not wide receiver one role. And the reason why I say wide receiver one role is that there's a lot of talk about him having a fantastic connection with Austin Simmons, the projected starting quarterback for Ole Miss, both on and off the field. And we saw this last year when Austin Simmons came in during the bowl, or not the bowl game, the game against Georgia, right? He targeted the hell out of Lee. And again, clearly, you know, Lee was obviously a very good wide receiver in and of himself. This is not like a Miles Coleman situation, right, where Miles Coleman benefited heavily in that bowl game for North Texas because Drew Messemaker was his high school quarterback. Lee was already performing really well, but it got taken to a different level when Simmons was the starting quarterback out there, right? Lee projects really well for me as well. I think I have him currently as wide receiver 27. So I like the value of Lee a lot right now. And Stribling's right where I think he should go, but if you're going to ask me who would I rather take between these two, give me the guy that apparently has a great relationship with the starting quarterback and has also been with the team longer. So I'd rather have Lee than Stribling. What about you, Joe?
This is a tough one here. So I'm going to cover a couple of things, but just looking at Lane Kiffin's history, let's just look at what wide receiver roles were in what, you know, spots. Mm-hmm. Just that alone. And I'm going to combine balanced and slot together. So saying that Caden could be either one of those. The wide receiver one, 2 out of 6 years was a balanced or slot. The wide receiver two, 2 out of 6 years was a balanced or slot.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of the time fitting in as wide receiver three. So that's one thing I look at. But then when I kind of look at just target distributions between wide receiver one, wide receiver two, wide receiver three, there's not like huge differences like we see in other offenses. Like the ball gets spread around in this offense. So typically what you're finding and what I look at is touchdowns and, you know, yards after catch, you know, like your yards per reception. That seems to be the biggest difference makers.
Mm-hmm.
And what's tough with the slot is like the years where, like last year, he had 2 touchdowns. Whenever the slot is a wide receiver three, it's like 2 or 3 touchdowns. When it was wide receiver two at Florida Atlantic, it was only 2 touchdowns. When the slot was the wide receiver one at Florida Atlantic, it was 5 touchdowns. So it seems like touchdowns is what holds the slot back, in my opinion, when you look at this.
Mm-hmm.
But you bring up having a connection with your quarterback. So I think part of it will be just how's the play calling? How are they looking to feed the ball? Like they might just throw the ball. They might just throw up rebounds to Stribling in the red zone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that might just be the play called, and it doesn't matter what, you know, Simmons wants to do, or just Simmons may keep looking to Lee. I think there's definitely some, like, I see positives and negatives about Lee. I don't know where I stand yet is the one thing I'm going to say, but like, I kind of see this, like, you have that good connection. there's about, even if it's just a bump of only 10 targets,
That could be
but that
huge.
production's there and you're getting more red zone targets, or you know, like or just that percentage of red zone targets increases greatly because you have that connection. Like Caden Lee, I think it's one of those right now. I don't know if I can say he's wide receiver one. I think he's at the very least wide receiver three, because that's what that slot role has. My hunch is he's probably going to be a, you know, wide receiver two is probably his Goldilocks zone. And I think it's just all going to come down to the touchdowns. You know, yeah, where are they going to put those targets in the red zone?
And here's the
But
thing, like
if you're putting me on the spot, yeah, to put a bow on it, put me on the spot. I just feel like I'll invest in Stribling in the sixth round, which would be about my wide receiver three. And there's just a little more historical precedent of that role in this offense being a good fantasy wide receiver three, versus there are enough question marks with Lee, even though, yes, you can get him later. I mean, it's one of those, I think you could get both guys and it's going to be good. But if I had to pick one today, just because of the question marks, I would stick with Stribling over Lee.
I gave you my projection for Lee earlier, but I don't think I've told you what the targets I gave him. I gave him 75 targets, which I think is a fair assumption to give
Oh,
as
yeah.
like a wide receiver two for the system, and that still was enough to kind of get him into my top 30 wide receivers. I think Lee has a very, very good ceiling, and I think he could be an NFL wide receiver at one point, which I
Oh,
think
yeah.
also kind of elevates the potential of I mean, Jordan Watkins got taken by the NFL draft. And I think a lot of us are surprised by that. I don't think anybody will be surprised if Lee's taken in a couple of years. And that, I think, kind of elevates the ceiling of what we can expect out of a slot receiver for Ole
Well, and
Miss.
if you want to know how much I like Lee in my home league, which is a keeper league, I was stockpiling some talent at the end of the year and I grabbed Caden Lee. So, I mean, like to be like, I don't know if he'll be one of my four keepers, but I believed in him enough where I went out and grabbed him. So I'm right there with you. And I'm looking at, you know, full season, not 12 game season stats for Lane Kiffin. His wide receiver two averages exactly 73 targets.
There we go. All right, let's move on to another wide receiver room. You wanted to talk about the Wake Forest wide receiver room, and you're making my heart hurt here a little bit. Not because, here's the thing, Joe, not because you're going against the grain. The thing is, I'm
No, you're
afraid
trying to steal.
I'm a af I'm afraid you're no, here's the thing, Joe. I'm afraid you're right. Is the thing I'm scared about here. Wake Forest wide receivers, obviously, I have touted the likes of Carlos Hernandez. He's currently coming off the board as wide receiver 49, beginning of the 15th round, literally right in the middle of drafts. And then the other guy we need to talk about here today is Mr. Micah Mayes, who's currently going undrafted in, I'd say, every draft. That may not last for very long, especially if we talk about him here today. But Joe,
Yeah.
Mayes has been the one kind of getting the buzz from spring camp right now. So I'll let you kind of take over from here. What's going on here?
Well, to steal one of your lines, it's been a steady drumbeat all spring long about Mays. That really does stand out to me. All of us were really looking at Hernandez, and a lot of just kind of how we viewed it is just from an overall talent standpoint, we just felt like Hernandez was the best guy in that room. So we all kind of were leaning that way. Their offensive coordinator, Rob Ezel, he was the offensive coordinator for 1 year at South Alabama. He was not the play caller. We cannot take too much out of last year's South Alabama stats, but the one thing that we did look at, and with Hernandez, like, you know, hey, they prefer a slot. And actually, I need to double check. Bear with me here. I think they both play on the outside.
So
Hernandez, yes. Yeah, Hernandez, they both play on the outside.
well, Hernandez can do both. That's kind of that
Yeah,
was also one of
yeah.
the main things that kind of sold me on the idea of Hernandez, right? Is like he can fill that kind of role that Jamal Pritchett and Colin Lacey did those last 2 years that Ezell was there at South Alabama. Was like yes, they mostly played in the slot, but they can be moved both inside and outside. Hernandez can do that. I don't know if Mays can do that, right? But we also have a limited sample size with Mays.
Well, and to me, I really look at Ezel. We have 1 year and he wasn't even the play caller. It was, you know, it wasn't really his offense. If you want to kind of think about that. So from a wide receiver role too, I'm not going to lean too much on the fact that the slot part of it, which opens up the idea of Mays. So when you think of what can you really hang your hat on, we don't have a great coaching history, like a rock solid one that we could say we definitely know is a slot guy. that what it leaves us with is what we heard all camp, which was Mays was just making plays left and right all camp. So it, like if you're just going to go on coach's word, I think you have to assume he's the wide receiver one.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, free. This is definitely one of those situations. And I think I took Hernandez in my last Diary of a Draft Man draft. But like, you know, a lot of us who are taking Hernandez, I think there's going to be a switch. So for everybody watching the show, on, you know, if you guys hadn't already been hearing about Micah Mays, this is it. Like his price is going up.
Oh yeah. He won't be right? undrafted
be
for
ready.
Long.
It's going to go up, and it's going to go up quick. So take advantage of it now, but I will not be surprised if it in 30 days, he's being drafted in the teens of rounds, not the 20s or undrafted.
I sure hope not, because even then, I think I'll be going too high there. His projection is weird to me, right? Because like I agree with you. Once I started hearing that city drum beat, I'm like, all right, I got to back off on Hernandez mm-hmm. just a little bit, right? Because he's not the one being mentioned. It's literally like they ask about offensive players that are standing out, and just the first name out of their mouth every time is Micah Mays, right? I got to take that seriously.
Coaches and reporters.
So
it's not just one or the other.
So and so like I gave Mays 90 targets, right? But here's the thing. He's only reeled in about half the balls that have been thrown his way, and that does hold his projection back a little bit, especially since he's only been getting about 13.6 yards per reception. Even with 90 targets, that would project out to about 626 yards. Given the way they're talking about him, I have to imagine that he'll outperform that this year. It sounds like he's taking a real step there.
Well, and change at quarterback position too. So
part yeah, they of got the Sean Purdy.
Percentage. Well, no, but I mean, but part of his completion or catch percentage before, how much of that was on him dropping it? How much of that was on bad, you know, like bad throws by the quarterback? I don't have an answer for that. I'm just bringing that up as something of like, probably in my projections, I'll just use a career average of catch percentage to try and get to a reception
mm-hmm.
versus just trying to use his numbers.
Okay, yeah, to be fair, so Hank Bachmeier completed about 62.3% of his passes last year. Micah Mays reeled in about 51.6% of his passes. Granted, he could have been playing a lot with Michael Kern, considering that I think Mays was on the second team last year for Wake Forest, so probably catching some balls from him. And then Micah Mays, let's see, where's his receiving? That's rushing. I don't care about his rushing. Let's see, drop percentage. He has a drop percentage of 11.1%. That's pretty hefty.
Okay.
But even still, right, like, given the way they're talking about it, you have to imagine that that'll improve quite a bit this year. So, but I agree with you, like, I've backed off on Hernandez a little bit. I had him projected as high as, you know, wide receiver 13. I've backed mm-hmm. off a little bit since then. I got him as wide receiver 22 now. That could come down even further if there continues just to be no word whatsoever. And like you said, Joe, this all could be for nothing. This could be Rob Azell comes in, he spreads the ball around, and we're all just spending way too much time on an offense that we have no idea what's going to happen here.
You mentioning that would be a good point of like, maybe we don't get that 120 target wide receiver one. Maybe they're a 95 target wide receiver one because they also have a really good wide receiver two, and that person's getting 75 targets.
Yep. I currently have both Hernandez and Mays projected at 90 targets just for my ranking purposes. And again, Hernandez obviously comes out much better on that. He has a much higher catch percentage than Micah Mays, right? So that benefits him quite a bit there. But even still, like, let's move on to our second to last team we want to discuss. So we're going from Wake Forest. Now we're going to the receiver room over at Mizzou. Another team that I kind of realized a week or two ago that we're all kind of betting on Kevin Coleman, right? Wide receiver 30 in drafts, eighth round and everything like that. And I don't blame people, right? Again, we saw him do it last year at Mississippi State on what I would say is an objectively worse roster. Right, he performed pretty well in the SEC, catching about 72.5% of his balls, 12.6 yards per catch, almost 1,000 yards. Like, you would think the logic would then follow that, hey, he's going to Mizzou. He's going to that Luther Burden spot, right, that has been very productive for Luther Burden until last year, whatever happened there, I'm not sure. But even still, like, you would think that would be the good spot. But then I remembered there's a little squeaker, not squeaker, he's a big dude, but Marquise Johnson, wide receiver there at Mizzou, he had himself a really, really nice bowl game there. I think it was like 12 targets, 7 catches, 100 and something yards. Here it is. 11 targets, 7 catches, 122 yards, and a touchdown. He is a very efficient wide receiver. He has been with this system already, right? He has averaged 19.3 yards per catch in his career. Do I think he'll continue that into this next year? Probably not. But regardless, he's clearly a big play threat for Mizzou. Typically, it is the slot for Kirby Moore that sees the volume, that sees kind of the benefit. But if you're averaging almost, 17 to 19 yards per catch, you don't really need to be that clear number one guy for Mizzou in order to benefit greatly from that. So I'm pointing out that Marquise Johnson currently going as wide receiver 135 in drafts in the 29th round is a great value because he could be a pretty solid wide receiver too if he can just get, close to 50 catches. That can get him to 1,000 yards based on his current reception or current receiving average. And there's also the possibility that he just is the wide receiver one for Mizzou, in which case you're talking about a ceiling of, what did I put him at? With Kevin Coleman, I currently have Kevin Coleman projected at 90 targets. If you gave Marquise Johnson 90 targets, you're talking about a league winner at wide receiver. I currently have him projected at 75 targets, and that's enough to get Marquise Johnson in my top 35 wide receivers for projections. So I'm just saying, Marquise Johnson, you were saying earlier, Xavier Townsend's a great value. I think Marquise Johnson might be one of the best values out there right now.
I love that you picked this one out because I'm big on Marquise Johnson too. Once again, my historical database is the full seasons, not 12 games. But the wide receiver too for Kirby Moore, 99 targets, 80 targets, 97 targets for the 3 years. I got a great question for you. If you were going to take a ballpark guess, how much fantasy point difference for the career average of the wide receiver one to wide receiver two of Kirby Moore? How much do you think that gap is?
Last year it was not much at all. I know that because what's his name? The former Oklahoma wide receiver, not Mookie Cooper, it was Theo Weiss. He was very close to Luther Burden in production because, again, like in the slot, it's less efficiency, higher volume. Outside guys tend to be lower volume, but much higher efficiency, right? So I would imagine that evens out pretty well over time, especially in a system like this.
So career average for Kirby Moore, it's a difference of 38 fantasy points on a season. So let's keep that in mind and look at the prices here.
Mm-hmm.
You have to take Johnson.
Yeah. For quick context, Kevin Coleman going off in the 8th round versus Marquise Johnson going off in the 29th round.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry for all of you audio listeners. I'm sorry. Nope, but yeah, it's just like it's just one of those, I'm going to round it up and just say 40-point difference historically between a wide receiver one and wide receiver two. And we're talking about this as if Johnson is the wide receiver two. Mm-hmm. Talking about like the low end of it. 40 points less, but you can get him 21 rounds later. That's a steal. Yeah.
Yeah. I would agree. All right. Last one we're going to discuss.
Sorry. There's one potential red flag, though.
So there's always red flags.
Bo Prebula. How good is he going to be at throwing the ball? I think that's just a valid question to throw out there.
Agreed.
Could the overall efficiency stats, pass efficiency stats of the offense go down with him at quarterback? I do think that's one genuine concern to have with either of these two guys. Another thing as well is when the protection breaks down and he starts to scramble, is he going to scramble to throw or is he just going to scramble to run, which will take away throwing opportunities from the receivers? I do think those are two big question marks that we're not really going to know all summer long, but that's something that could potentially limit the fantasy potential of Missouri receivers.
I mean, that's a fantastic point to bring up for sure. Last team we'll discuss here. We're actually going back to a team we discussed earlier, but we got to discuss a different room here. And that is the Penn State tight ends. We had to sneak in at least one tight end conversation into this show for all you tight end enthusiasts out there. And what other tight end room is there to be excited about than the Penn State tight end room that just gave us Tyler Warren's insane season last year? The two guys here, Luke Reynolds, currently going off the board as tight end 20 in ADP, and then Andrew Rapoyea, the tight end 38 in drafts right now. You're talking about a difference between the 19th round versus the 28th round, about 10 rounds different, 9-10 rounds difference between these two guys. So, Joe, I have a definitive answer on which guy I'd rather take out of these two, but I will send it over to you because you were the one who brought this up. What are your thoughts?
I brought it up mainly because it's coming out in my Thursday handcuff article, and I'm writing it today as we're recording. It's a funky situation. In my article, I did sit there and say, I think you have to, without going through the full backstory, just to get to the end of it, I think you have to lean on Luke Reynolds today and wait to hear about the health status of Rapoyea in fall camp. I do think, but at the same time, at least with this question, I don't mind, and it depends on how many, like right now, Jared, how many tight ends are you typically drafting in a best ball league?
I've been averaging 3 to 4.
I've been sticking at 4 since quarterback's more reliable this year. I've been going 6 quarterbacks and just trying to get an extra tight end because some of it is it's just like I don't mind with a 4th tight end taking a wild card shot.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, Rapoyea would be like a tight end 4 where in that scenario, I don't mind taking him over Reynolds because I would have gotten some other guys in my first 3 spots instead of Reynolds. So I kind of have an answer for both. But the only time I would pick Rapoyea is just because like it is my wild card shot as a tight end 4. Maybe it lands. If it doesn't, I'm okay if it misses. But for everybody that's listening, though, like Rapoyea was the tight end 2 last year at the start of the year. He injured his leg, missed the entire season. When he went down, Reynolds stepped in then as the new tight end 2. Reynolds is the best healthy guy on the roster. Go ahead. I see you itching.
I'm itching here because actually that's not correct. Reynolds was tight end 3 last year. Penn State runs a lot of 2 tight end sets, and they have 2 very distinct roles with their tight ends. They have like your typical prototypical tight end, then they have like a flex option. Last year, your 2 starters were Tyler Warren at the flex option and then Khalil Dinkins as like that prototypical inline guy, right? Reynolds got a lot of run as the direct backup to Tyler Warren, right?
That's what I'm trying to say. Sorry. When I say tight end 2, I'm talking about in that line of, Warren's position. Sorry.
Gotcha. I just want to make sure that people understood that Penn State runs tons of tight end, like tons of 2 tight end sets. So like you said, like you could be talking about tight end 2 as in like, you know, really the flex 2. Right. Versus like some people might be thinking like, oh, is he then on the same on the field at the same time as Warren with 2 tight end sets out there?
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Very good point to help clarify for the listeners. That's what I was trying to say, that Rapoyea was Warren's backup. Reynolds stepped into that when Rapoyea went down with injury. So the one thing that like I take from that is Rapoyea was considered better than Reynolds at the start of last fall by the coaches.
I'm actually going to disagree with you again.
You're going to disagree?
I'm going to disagree because I think Rapoyea was the starter. He Dinkins took the place of Rapoyea. Because if you look at these snap percentages, right? First of all, Reynolds obviously clearly a more receiving threat, right? He's got 12.3 yards per catch versus Dinkins when he got the ball, it was like, you know, 8.6. So there's very clearly a difference in roles there. Reynolds had 5.3% pass block compared to Rapoyea when he was on the field, 18.2% pass block. Reynolds had 39.4% slot. Rapoyea had 9.1%. They both had about a quarter of their snaps out wide, which I find kind of interesting. But then you also have Reynolds only having 31% of his snaps being in line versus Rapoyea had 63.6% of his in line. That is a snap distribution that's way more like Dinkins compared to Warren, right? While Reynolds was getting a lot more work like Warren. That's why I'm heavily involved or heavily putting my flag down of like Reynolds is the guy to get here. If you want the potential of Warren, he's the guy to go after. Right.
Good
Even if
point.
he is, if he, even if he is more expensive at tight end 20, I think that ceiling's worth it. It's not like he's being drafted like, you know, Kenyon Sadiq now, who's being drafted, you know, seventh, like fifth, sixth, seventh round of drafts. I think Reynolds is a great value currently where he's going there in the 19th round.
Good point. Glad you brought it up while we're recording here today. I got time to fix my article.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, that, but again, that was something that kind of caught my eye, right? Was like, I'm like, yo, yeah, that is interesting that Rapalje did get the start last year. So that does kind of add a little bit of mystery to this room, right? Of like, oh, well, if he is healthy, do they then consider him better? But no,
yeah,
I
and
think
he did not participate or anything in the spring. And yeah,
exactly.
So it's like he might be one of the, another one of those guys too, like where his, he might not even be 100% by the opener for all we know.
Exactly. Well, there's that. And then again, as I was looking at these snap counts, I'm like, okay, there's a very clear difference in roles between these two guys. And mm-hmm. Reynolds is the guy that is the one we want for fantasy. Because unfortunately, as of yet, we do not have fantasy points per block.
One thing I do want to bring up, and yes, fantasy points per block. One thing I do want to point out there, though, for everybody listening, is that like, you need to forget about what Tyler Warren did last year. You are
oh,
not
going
to get 200. You're not going to get 200 fantasy points out of this position from Penn State. And really, I think probably if without even running projections, like I think like you can expect something, let's say 75 to the 90 point range. Just not even looking at numbers, just shooting something off the top of my, you know, off the hip, I think would be a safe area that you could estimate with a potential ceiling that can go higher. But I think like a pretty reliable, like I have a hard time believing that we're just going to crown Luke Reynolds here. I have a hard time seeing him scoring less than 75 points. Would you agree?
I would agree, right? Again, Penn
yeah.
State's one of the safest tight end floors that you can get. It's the same thing as like the Georgia, why people started drafting the Georgia tight end room after Brock Bowers left, right? It's a talent. It's a room chock full of talent. It's a system that's clearly willing to use the tight end in a receiver role, which is not something we really see a ton of anymore, right? So I agree with you. Like, Reynolds is a fantastic grab in terms of just the absolute floor they can get with a much higher ceiling there. I don't have tight end projections done yet. Yeah. Believe it or not, they are not the highest of my priority.
Just keep your expectations grounded. But
that's why he's going tight end 20 right now. I'd still be okay even if he got into the top 12. It's just don't go crazy like people are kind of going with Kenyon Sadiq right now, which I need to look into Sadiq again, because like the hype train on him is starting to get a little bit out of control.
But I'm kind of starting to believe it too, though. It's still one of those things where I'm kind of doing those. Why I say I don't have player rankings yet, and I'm still doing like just first run blind projections. Like I want to see everyone filtered in with everyone before I start really kind of making some hard opinions. And I've been saying it a lot on my podcast, but like I'm about to do a ton of traveling this month. I was just on the road last week. I was in Vegas and only lost $65. Did good. But one of those things of just like, you know, I think you get to a point where you just need to see everyone in comparison with everyone before you start getting a good feel of, because it's easy before we do that as analysts to say, well, I just love this guy. Okay. Let's see him in the crowd. You know, like you might sit there and be like, oh, I way over projected here. Mm-hmm. You know, like that, like a lot of times we start to have that, you know, so we do first run projections and then we go back and we'll kind of, you know, do a second run, and then you might even do a third or fourth run of remassaging things as well. So,
I mean, that's exactly what I've done with Carlos Hernandez, right? Like, again, you asked me a month ago, I'd be like, yeah, he's the best value in drafts right now. Like, you absolutely should be drafting. You could be drafting him as high as wide receiver 15, and I wouldn't care. Now I'm sitting here like, ooh, maybe I was getting a little over my skis on that, just a little bit. All right. Great discussion, Joe. Always glad to have you on, man. You bring a ton of great analysis here. Again, we kind of talked already earlier, kind of what you've been doing and what you plan on doing and everything like that. But I guess real quick before we get out of here, just you want to remind everybody the great stuff you're working on over there at letpurplerain.com.
Yeah. Some of the things here. Number one, I'm hosting an amazing 52 man league that Jared is one of our special contestants in. All premium subscribers to letpurplerain.com are automatically entered into the lottery drawings to get one of the 48 subscriber team spots. And I'm having my third golden ticket giveaway for the premium subscribers to get a chance to enter this league. It's happening. This episode is airing on a Monday. I'm going to be doing that live drawing this Wednesday. So if you guys do watch this show and you want to have a chance to enter the league, go sign up to be a premium subscriber. You can get your name potentially pulled this Wednesday. And then throughout the month of May here, I'm making the transition and shift over to focusing on draft content for you guys. The cornering the market handcuffing article is going to be coming out later this week. Then I'm going to be doing a whole run on what I call risers and flyers. So guys that have had some fantasy production in the past, but expect to see a big jump this year. And I just call sleepers flyers. I'm just using a different terminology, but everybody loves sleeper articles. I'm going to be doing a 4-part series for each position, as well as eventually a nuclear options and a really late covering the spring transfer portal article. That'll wrap up my coverage for May.
Well, there you guys go. Again, Joe, one of the hardest working people in CFF. He does a ton of great work. Be sure to go and give him some of your patronage. He does a fantastic job. On our end, we have come to the end of this show. Appreciate all of you guys for listening. If you have not already, make sure you like, comment, and subscribe. If you're watching this on YouTube, if you're on the podcast side of things, make sure you follow the show. Leave a 5-star review wherever you can. Make sure you guys check out the rest of the Campus to Canton Podcast Network for shows ranging on pretty much anything you could think of related to the college fantasy game. We'll see you guys back here next Monday, where we'll have another great topic of college fantasy for you guys. Until then, really appreciate you guys and hope you guys have a wonderful, blessed week. See y'all.